This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. When the pandemic hit last March, many Americans faced the challenge of supporting loved ones in nursing homes from afar and keeping them safe, including Dan in West Bend, Wisconsin.
My 83-year-old mother is in a nursing home with memory care. What has changed for her with the pandemic is the lack of interaction with any other person, as well as the food. Used to be catered meals in a room surrounded by other people. It changed to food delivered to the door, which was much less in terms of quality and no personal interaction. She hated it. She ended up moving home.
For many who need long-term care, aging at home simply isn't an option, and that's why nursing homes exist. But as the pandemic rages on, it's exposed more and more cracks in the system, and many are calling for reform. With us to talk about it is Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. That's a nonprofit that advocates for quality care for residents in care facilities. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Susan Jaffe. She's a contributing writer for Kaiser Health News, covering health policy and aging. She's also the DC correspondent for The Lancet, which is a medical journal. Susan, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
So I want to start with a voicemail we got from one of our listeners.
Something that definitely needs to be addressed in nursing homes is the amount of greed that's rampant in the for-profit sector of nursing homes. I have worked in for-profit and not-for-profit nursing facilities, and the difference in attitudes and practices is astounding. The amount of understaffing that goes on in certain facilities is absolutely mind-boggling and frustrating. Certain things such as showers don't happen for residents because we're too busy running around trying to keep our incontinent patients clean. Frankly, for all of these company people, these big wigs, these CEOs, the people that we're caring for, to them, they aren't someone's parent or grandparent or loved one. They're simply a check to fill their pockets.
So, Susan, first off, I want to establish the difference between for-profit and non-profit care homes. Can you lay it out for us?
I think probably Richard has a better idea, but my understanding is that, you know, for-profit nursing homes have to, you know, satisfy, make their shareholders happy. There is a certain amount of revenue that comes in ostensibly for the care of the nursing home resident, but some of that money gets diverted for other purposes that are not at all related to the care of the nursing home resident.
Richard, anything to add?
I'd say Susan is exactly right. I mean, what we've seen is an increasing corporatization of the nursing home sector because, frankly, there's so much money to be made and so little accountability for where that money goes.
Well, according to market research firm Ibis World, the nursing home industry is valued at $141 billion. That was in 2021. But Richard, are nursing homes always lucrative businesses?
I would say, well, you know what? That's a good question. I would say that the answer is probably yes, based upon the fact that we see one increased for-profit investment in the sector, and especially in recent years, and this has been more recently addressed by or started to be addressed by Congress, is we see a lot of private equity investment. We see a lot of real estate investment trusts. What we're seeing is a very sophisticated industry that is able to quite often hide profits. And so they pull money away from the operations, as Susan was saying as well, you know, on the ground. So they look impoverished, and they've been doing that for years to try to avoid any kind of accountability for lawsuits when someone is neglected, for instance, neglected to death. So it's become an even more sophisticated model, as I would say the real estate investment trusts and private equity have gotten into it. But it's very hard for us to see, because there's so little accountability and transparency for where the money goes.
How do nursing home residents pay for care?
Most long-term care is paid for through the Medicaid program in the United States. Most short-term care, you know, rehab care, is paid for through the Medicare program. And then there is a small amount, I think about roughly 15% nationwide, is paid for through private insurance or private pay.
Now, Susan, you've been reporting on the patchwork of new state laws designed to protect nursing home residents in response to the pandemic. Give us a sense of the various issues these states are trying to address.
Well, I'll tell you, one thing that impressed me when I was talking to these state lawmakers and I was watching some of the hearings that were held on the different kinds of legislation is that these lawmakers had personal stories. They had relatives in nursing homes or friends in nursing homes or friends who were trying to visit their family members and could not. And they were pleading with the lawmaker to see if they could help. And even, so you don't really get that kind of personal story when you're watching a legislative hearing. It's kind of like watching grass grow. But this was completely different. And, you know, some of the laws that they passed actually paint a very good picture of what kind of reforms are needed in every state. So I looked at, I was just reading legislation. It's not exactly the most exciting reading, but I was looking for states that had mentioned in their law, they mentioned the pandemic, they mentioned social isolation, and for example, they've changed some of the rules on visitation. We know that during the pandemic, one of the first things that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services did was to limit outsiders coming into the home. However, you know, they still had people delivering supplies. They still had employees coming in and out. Employees that sometimes have other jobs in other facilities, and that's how a lot. Unfortunately, that's how COVID probably got into these nursing homes through people who were coming in and out. So there was a legitimate reason for limiting visitation. And now some states have created what's called an essential support person who can visit, that they are designated as sort of like the, you know, like the designated driver. Mm-hmm. And they are coming in to not just to visit. I mean, the Arkansas legislator who I spoke to, who sponsored the essential support person law in her state, she calls it No Patient Left Behind. And she said these are not people that are just coming in with flowers and a greeting card. These are people who help their loved one eat, help them change clothes, keep an eye on what's happening in the nursing home. Mm-hmm. It's not just a social visit.
It's so more comprehensive than that. Richard, according to the AARP, at least 186,000 residents and staff at long-term care facilities have died of COVID-19. Broadly speaking, how have nursing homes responded to the pandemic and how have they been impacted by it over the last year and a half?
Those are really good questions. Unfortunately, we've seen the resident population more than decimated. We had over 1 million nursing home residents before the pandemic, in the U.S. Now, last I looked, I think it's about 850,000 or so. So it's been an enormous decrease. Many of them, of course, died. And some people, wherever possible, avoided, going to a nursing home during this time. But with the staffing, it was quite a bit less so. So, staff tend to be younger, of course, less medically fragile. So there were less staff that were directly impacted by COVID-19. But then again, a lot of staff have families, et cetera. Some staff were hesitant to go into nursing homes. But most of what we've seen is exactly what Susan was saying, is that, those staff were in and out. Staff tend to be very poorly paid in nursing homes as compared to other healthcare settings. It's always listed in the census, U.S. Census, as being the most dangerous or the second most dangerous occupation to be a nurse aide. So it's tough work, and there's challenges to keeping going if you're a nurse aide or a care staff person in a nursing home?
You know, the pandemic exposed cracks in our long-term care system, like insufficient staffing at nursing homes. But advocates have been calling for change long before the pandemic hit the U.S. What are some of the most pressing issues on your mind right now?
Well, most important, I think, you know, throughout history or throughout modern history in the nursing home sector is staffing. You know, nursing homes have long had staffing issues. We don't have a set numerical staffing requirement in the United States. Some states have numerical requirements. By that, I mean that they have to have a certain number of RNs, licensed practical nurses, and certified nurse aides in the facility per resident per day. But we don't have that nationally.
Well, here's a tweet we got from Sean. My 89-year-old wheelchair-bound grandfather was in a nursing home, and we moved him to in-home care because the standard of care was so subpar. He gets better care from my 84-year-old grandmother. She can hardly walk without needing assistance, but he still receives better care from her and from a nurse coming in 3 days a week than from full-time care in a nursing home. And Pat emailed, the first thing that has to happen with the abysmal state of care in nursing homes and other long-term care facilities is to take the profit out of it, make them all nonprofit. It's not a panacea, but we'll move closer to an elder care system that is truly caring. We're talking with Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. Susan Jaffe, she's a contributing writer for Kaiser Health News. And coming up, we'll hear from a current resident about her experience living in a nursing home during the pandemic. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're talking about nursing homes and long-term care with Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. That's a nonprofit that advocates for quality care for residents in care facilities. Also with us is Susan Jaffe. She covers health policy and aging for Kaiser Health News. She's also the D.C. correspondent for The Lancet, which is a medical journal. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Joining us now is Jeanette Sullivan Martinez. She's a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut. Jeanette, thanks for joining us. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we also want to hear from you. If you or a loved one live in a nursing home or other long-term care facility, what has life been like during the pandemic? And what changes would you like to see at your residence or in long-term care more broadly? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Now, Jeanette, you've been at Pendleton for 13 years. Tell us about the circumstances that led you to become a long-term resident.
I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when I was 28, and around the age of 44, my disability became to a point where I could no longer live at home safely, and I chose to come to a nursing facility because I had young adult children at the time. I'm divorced, young adult children, and my son had said to me, "Mom, I'll just stay home. I won't go to college. I'll stay home to take care of you," and for me, that was not an option. I felt that my children, as all of us do as parents, want to see our children become successful and move forward in their lives. And I didn't want to feel like I was a burden or an obligation. So the most reasonable choice for me was to come to a nursing facility. It was a difficult choice because I was only 44 years old at the time. But that was the main reason that I came here.
What kind of care and assistance do you receive each day?
I am total care. So I need help with bathing, toileting, transferring. I can no longer walk. I have difficulty with my hands at times. So there are days where my multiple sclerosis is a little bit more active or I'm not as able to function. I may need some assistance in eating at times. So I'm classified as total care. I tell everybody, my body is slowing down, but my brain is still very much alive. And so is my mouth. So I like to be a voice to help others in my situation and make it better.
Well, we know that nursing homes across the country have been hit especially hard during the pandemic. What have you seen and experienced at Pendleton since last March?
Well, staffing was a difficulty prior to the pandemic, as was in all nursing homes. but it's become horrific or horrifying since pandemic, because most of our medical healthcare people are no longer working. There's 8 to 10,000 out of work just in the state of Connecticut by choice, being fearful of coming in and infecting their own families, having children out of school, having to stay home to take care of them. So lack of staffing has been a huge issue in nursing homes throughout the state, but also specifically in mine, which means you wait longer. If you ring to have to use the bathroom, or if you're in bed and need the bedpan, you wait longer for somebody to come and help you. You wait longer to get your meals. Everything is times two as far as what it used to be. And like I was mentioned earlier, there are times where you don't get a shower because there's not enough staff to deal with the immediate needs on the floor, to be able to take that 30, 40 minutes to take someone down to the shower room, bathe them, bring them back, dress them, get them set up for their day. That part has been extremely difficult.
And what about COVID specifically? How was Pendleton impacted?
COVID did not hit. We managed to stay COVID-free until December. December 1st, we had our first outbreak, and it swept through our building. We are a 120-bed facility. I think we probably had 80 or 90 residents or people here in the building. We also do short-term rehab. We have 60 long-term care. Out of 60 patients that I'm aware of, only four of us did not get contract COVID. Wow. Two of us were in independent rooms, and two gentlemen just did not get ill. They were very careful with their, making sure people wore the PPE and all of that. I think the isolation was probably one of the most difficult things. We're in our rooms with the door shut. The only interaction you have is if you ring because you need assistance in some way, specifically toileting, or if and when they brought your meals to you. So that was very difficult.
Were you able to communicate virtually with loved ones outside Pendleton?
I was. I was very fortunate that my family, even prior to that, had set me up with an iPad. I do have a cell phone that my family does pay for. So I was able to do FaceTime with them, which was terrific for me. I have my oldest daughter was pregnant during COVID. My first grandchild was born May 10th, 2020. And then my second granddaughter was born this past January. So my being able to see them was basically through FaceTime. Yeah. We were not allowed visitation here, not even window visits, because if the weather was favorable, they would allow some of our residents to be outside distancing. So that was very, very difficult.
Richard, how does Jeanette's experience square with what you've heard from residents around the country?
Well, it sounds a lot like what we hear from residents around the country. I mean, difficulty with visitation, but the isolation, the lack of care services, it's, I've been doing this for close to 20 years, and still it's, every story I hear is upsetting and heartbreaking, because this shouldn't be happening even in the face of COVID. It's not supposed to be a warehouse, and nursing homes are not supposed to accept or retain residents for whom they don't have enough staff and supplies to provide appropriate care with dignity. And that, there were a lot of rules that were relaxed at the beginning of the pandemic for nursing homes, but those rules were not relaxed to provide appropriate care and services, to provide appropriate bathing and food and activities. And some nursing homes did it. And that's in some ways the most infuriating part, is that, we've talked about staffing before, and most nursing homes have been understaffed for decades, but about 25% of nursing homes do have good staff. It can be done. And some nursing homes did a really good job with caring for their residents, safeguarding their residents, and providing humane services to their residents during the pandemic. But the problem fundamentally is that there's so little enforcement in this country of those rules that too many providers will skimp on them, and they get away with it.
Well, Susan, you've been reporting about how the world of virtual legislatures and Zoom has opened the door for nursing home residents like Jeanette to advocate for themselves. Tell us more about what you heard from residents.
Well, first of all, when nursing homes went on lockdown, you know, the rest of the world was also closed. People didn't go to work, including, you know, lawmakers. So they were on Zoom or FaceTime, just like everybody else. And all of a sudden, nursing home residents were on the same playing field as their state representatives, and they could communicate using the same technology that everybody else was using, and they were able to exercise their rights as citizens to lobby their state legislatures. And when these different laws, legislation proposals came up to address some of the gaps in the federal nursing home regulations, you know, like visiting, like staffing, creating the essential support person, they also had in several states legislation about technology. In just this past year, after many months of COVID, there are some states now, including Connecticut, that the nursing home residents actually testified on to make the technology a permanent part of residents' life. So people like Jeanette don't have to travel, however, you know, with a wheelchair van and a nursing assistant, and they were able to now use this technology. In Connecticut, and I think Jeanette can correct me if I'm wrong, in Connecticut, nursing homes now have to provide free internet service.
Is that accurate, Jeanette?
I believe so, yes. Also, we need to be resident council presidents need to be contacted prior to a bill being changed that would affect the lives of people living in nursing homes. They need to give us a 7-day notice so that we have the opportunity to speak out on our own behalves. And I personally have testified on several public hearings with regards to legislation that affects people living in nursing homes. So yes, that's very true.
Susan, before we let you go, you talked a lot about what's happening at the state level, and that's going to vary broadly depending upon where you live. But at the federal level, are there any moves to reform the way our nursing home system works?
Well, you know, I think states can be a little, I don't know if this is saying very much, but compared to Congress, states can be a little bit more nimble. They're closer to their constituents. And Congress is really busy with lots of things. But there is legislation pending that would apply some of these state laws. They adapt these ideas so that they would be available to everybody, no matter where you live. But right now, we have a situation, unfortunately, where we are increasing the inequities in healthcare, because not everybody can live in a nursing home in Connecticut. So you have different staffing ratios. I mean, in Connecticut passed a law requiring a certain amount of hours per day of direct care, but it's different. It's 3 hours in Connecticut, but next door in Massachusetts, it's 3.5 hours. In Rhode Island, it's 3.8 hours. In some states, there's zero. They're silent on it.
Lots of variation from state to state. That's Susan Jaffe. She covers health and aging for Kaiser Health News. She's also the D.C. correspondent for The Lancet, which is a medical journal. Susan, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking with advocate Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. Also with us is Jeanette Sullivan Martinez. She's a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut. And let's bring one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now is Mark Parkinson. He's the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association. It represents long-term and post-acute care providers. He's also the former Democratic governor of Kansas. Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Jen. Great to be here.
Here's an email we got from Robert who says, one of the critical issues that needs to be addressed is the wages of caretakers. My mother spent the last 4 years of her life in a nursing home. Some of her best caretakers had to quit because they could not support themselves on the wages they were paid. One of them became like family and told me if she didn't share rent with another worker, they would both be homeless. She loved her job but ended up leaving for a factory job, and this was before COVID was an issue. Now, Mark, as we've discussed, some of the challenges facing nursing homes existed in many facilities before the pandemic, like low pay and inadequate staffing levels. To your view, to what extent could some of this devastation have been prevented if those issues had been addressed earlier?
Well, I think you're right. I think the panelists have been correct that COVID really did underscore the systemic problems in nursing homes. And, you know, I think it's difficult and probably a mistake to have a broad brush on the sector as a whole. There are certainly outstanding buildings out there that are for-profit and not-for-profit. And although the individual stories that people have told are really regrettable, when you look at the overall picture, the data indicates that on a whole bunch of indicators, facilities have been getting gradually better over the years, but there's still a long way to go. And I think the reason there's a long way to go in large part is because of staffing and the underpay of staffing. And when you really dive into that problem, it exposes the basic problem, which is the chronic underfunding of Medicaid. Yeah. There are super nice facilities out there that rich people can live in. Some of them are for profit. Some of them are not for profit. But the poor people that run out of their funds live in Medicaid facilities. And so the bad stories that you hear and the criticism that you hear from folks are typically in the states that have made the deliberate policy decision to underfund nursing homes, really a bad idea.
Jeanette, it sounded like you wanted to jump in there.
Sure. I was going to say, I completely agree with him. I have seen in the 13 years I've lived here how staffing has changed, but it's because the wages have not. Our people, you know, here, the nurses and especially the CNAs, they make sometimes less than what a student just starting a job at McDonald's makes flipping hamburgers. And I think that's ludicrous because it's like apples to oranges. Flipping a burger for someone and then physically caring, dressing, clothing, bathing, and feeding someone should be so regarded so much higher, and the wage should be so much higher.
Richard, your thoughts?
I really think there should be a change there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Richard.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, the problem that we have is that there is... One, it is a highly profitable industry. As I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of real estate investment trusts going in, private equity and private investment, siphoning money out. There was an excellent article in the New York Times 2 years ago that found that 85% of U.S. nursing homes use what are called related party transactions. And that's a common way to siphon off funds that are meant for resident care, both Medicaid and Medicare, to profits in related companies under the same owner. But I think most importantly, this was one of the most profound studies that I've read in my career, is the U.S. Inspector General for Health and Human Services did a study a few years ago that found that for Medicare beneficiaries, these are people for whom nursing homes receive between $400 and $800 per day to provide care. The profits in Medicare have been over 10%, even with the related party transactions and the money being pulled away, over 10% profits for close to 20 years. One third of residents, the people who went into nursing homes for rehab, were harmed within an average of 2 weeks of entering the facility. And 6% of those residents died. And the OIG found that 59% of that harm was the result of substandard care. Even when there's high profits, facilities too often just don't do the right thing.
We're talking with Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. Also with us is Jeanette Sullivan Martinez. She's a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut. And Mark Parkinson. He's the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment. Now let's get back to our conversation about nursing homes and long-term care with this email from Peter, who says, my nursing home experience was very much like Jeanette's. I moved into a nursing home because of multiple sclerosis. I could not live in a house with stairs anymore. I have lots of technology to keep me connected to outsiders, so I was connected even through our pandemic lockdowns. I feel sorry for residents without technology because they were basically stuck in their room looking at four walls for almost 18 months. And with us is Jeanette Sullivan Martinez. She's a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut. Richard Mollett, he's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. That's a nonprofit that advocates for quality care for residents in care facilities. And Mark Parkinson, he's the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association. It represents long-term and post-acute care providers. He's also the former Democratic governor of Kansas. And we're also hearing from you.
My mother was in a nursing facility for about a month. Fortunately, she did get better and go back on her own, which is wonderful. But the point of this is that many of the staff were not vaccinated. The guests coming in, some of them I know specifically were not vaccinated. Nobody was checking. And this is all recent.
So I want to turn to this issue of vaccination because we also got this listener tweet that says, in the beginning of the pandemic, they locked down the whole facility where my mom lives. They refused entrance to visitors and permitted visits only through windows. When vaccines became available, everyone who's a resident was vaccinated, but whether or not vaccines were mandated for employees was not clear. Now, Mark, according to a new study out of the University of Rochester, nursing home aides were the workers least likely to be fully vaccinated against coronavirus by mid-July. Now, President Biden has since mandated vaccination for all nursing home workers. But as the head of the largest association representing long-term care providers, what's your reaction to that statistic?
Sure. Well, let me just first of all make a quick comment on Richard's comments. The continual statements that there's great profits in the nursing home business is just factually incorrect. There's an independent commission called the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission that analyzes the margins in nursing homes every year, and it finds the margins to be basically zero, with thousands of buildings operating at a loss. To look at this current situation and think that the solution is for nursing homes to make less money is just absurd. And it really takes the state legislators off the hook who are not adequately funding the staff wages under the Medicaid programs. In terms of vaccinations, we've made some significant progress, but we've got a ways to go. The first piece of news I want to give you and the listeners is really good news, and that is that the incidence of COVID in buildings is now 90% lower than it was at the peak. The number of deaths are 95% lower. So despite the fact that we don't have everyone vaccinated, these buildings have become quite safe. In terms of vaccinations, we started out really low on the staff side at 37%. We've increased the number now, and it's been increasing every week, and we're now at 65%. We're at over 80 to 85% for the residents. We still have a ways to go, but in most of these buildings, the vaccination rate's been quite high. The administration has announced that it's going to be mandating the vaccine for all nursing home staff in the next month or two. And so I expect that those numbers will improve. But the good news is we've been able to create a level of herd immunity despite the massive amount of COVID that's out in the general population.
Well, I think Richard, and I'll let you respond here to Mark's comment. But Mark, I think what Richard's point is that his study cites evidence that nursing home, some facilities are diverting money in ways that's difficult to track. Richard, is that accurate?
That's true. And it wasn't my research. It was actually research by a researcher and a writer named Jordan Rao, which was published in the New York Times 2 years ago. And again, I found that 85% of nursing homes, this was in 2018, were using what are called related party transactions. So just very quickly, what a nursing home operator will often do is they will buy a nursing home and then, for instance, in this situation, sell the nursing home building and the underlying property to another company, which they themselves own. And the issue, and really the heart, I think, of one of the foundations of the problems with nursing home care in this country is that they can then turn around and charge themselves 2-3 times the market rate for that property and starve the facility so the facility looks like it has low profits or no profits, but in fact, the operator is making a lot of money. I mean, the industry in this country is increasingly for profit, and there's a reason for that.
Well, Mark, I don't expect you and Richard to come to a point of agreement about this today, but I do know from the comments we're getting from listeners that there is this concern that residents aren't being cared for the way they should, that profits aren't going in the right areas, that people who work to take care of the folks we love who are in these care facilities, that they're underpaid. So where is there room for adjustment, as you see it, to perhaps make these long-term care facilities more focused on providing adequate wages for the people who are employed there and make sure that people who live there actually get the care they need?
This is very solvable. And the solution is that the state legislators in states that underfund Medicaid need to step up to the plate and prioritize residents and buildings and adopt legislation similar to what happened in Connecticut this year, where the legislation increases the wages for the workers and it goes directly to the workers. So it doesn't go to the owners that Richard is so concerned about. But if Richard and people like him continue to focus on what is not the issue, the issue is the chronic underfunding of Medicaid. It's not that the folks are making too much money. It's that there's just not enough money being put into the system. And so I think you have direct wage pass-throughs like occurred in Connecticut. I don't know if Jeanette would be able to comment on whether that's had any impact yet. But the legislature specifically increased funding and said all the money has to go to workers. And we're 100% for that. And we need people like Richard to, frankly, quit hammering us on situations that aren't reality and join with us in holding these legislators accountable for their years of underfunding.
Jeanette, I want to hear from you. And then, Richard, I'll give you a quick chance to chime in and then I want to move on. But, Jeanette, is this something you've been pushing for?
Yes, absolutely. I feel there needs to be a more accountability so that you can see that the workers are getting the money they need to get. I live in a great facility. The people that do work here are awesome and amazing people. And I feel very fortunate that this was the home that I was in during the pandemic and continue to feel that way. But I do believe there needs to be more legislative state recognition for our workers to be able to make a living wage. They shouldn't have to work 2 or 3 jobs to pay their bills. They should be able to come to work and feel like it's a career and not just a job. And when people feel like they're focused on having a career, they do a better job. They're more proud of themselves. They're proud of the work that they do. When it's just a job, they come and go. And there really isn't a lot of respect or appreciation for the people and the type of work that you're doing. And believe me, somebody in my situation where this really was not a choice, it was a choice that I had to make in one sense because I needed to be able to live and be taken care of, and I didn't have any other means. But I didn't wake up and just say, oh, I want to go live in a nursing home. But having good people to care for you makes the world of difference in how you face your day every day.
Richard, very briefly, is this funding of Medicaid the way Mark and Jeanette are describing it? Is that something that your organization supports?
No, absolutely. I mean, not on its face, not without having the transparency and the accountability and some kind of limit on profits, on administrative costs. Right now, again, there is, you know, some states have moved on this, New Jersey and New York being two that come to mind, and we haven't seen how that is going to come out in the wash yet.
You mean moved on increased accountability?
Moved on increased accountability, okay. But under the federal rules, and we are certainly advocating with the, you know, on this on the Hill and with CMS, but there is now no accountability. So again, nursing homes can pull out as much money as they want, both for-profit and not-for-profit can pay their administrators hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, the American Healthcare Association, which is the provider lobby group that Mark works for, they're sitting on over $30 million. Providers have the money, nursing homes have the money to throw funds into a lobby association that's lobbying our representatives in Congress and the people who are supposed to be assuring quality of care in the states and at CMS. $30 million. How many nursing home staff could that help?
Well, I want to turn to Capitol Hill, where we're seeing a number of measures that could impact the quality of care at nursing homes. Last month, Democratic senators unveiled the Nursing Home Improvement and Accountability Act, and it's unclear whether this particular bill will get traction. But Richard, what are some of your biggest policy priorities for long-term care?
Well, I think we need to have that accountability that I was just talking about. I mean, if in fact there's not enough money, we would certainly support more money going into it. But again, just throw money at the problem has never, ever worked. So we'd like to see the accountability. We'd like to see some kind of reasonable limitations on profits and knowing where the money goes. Right now, we don't even really have a good sense of and a accurate sense of where the money goes that goes into nursing homes. And I would say, secondly, we must have minimum staffing standards. We've known for over 20 years what it takes to provide at least decent clinical care to residents. There was a national study that came out in 2001. We need immediately to implement those immediate staffing standards. It's not supposed to be operated like a warehouse. It's a place for humans.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking with Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition. Also with us, Jeanette Sullivan Martinez, a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut, and Mark Parkinson. He's the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association. Jeanette, when we talk about this issue of accountability, what would you like to see?
I am all for that. Our building and facilities and even the ones locally around me were given money to handle part of the COVID. And, you know, we were told some of it went for PPE. Some of our staff during the COVID outbreak did receive small stipends to assist in their needs. But I think financially that Medicaid and even the Medicare system needs to be looked at a little tighter so that the money that is being sent to nursing homes is being used for the means in which they're supposed to be. I think that doesn't just trickle down for staffing, for like CNAs and nursing, but I think also laundry, housekeeping, dietary, all these people are very underpaid wage-wise, and people will do a better job if they're paid better, most likely, most of them anyway.
Mark, what accountability measures are your organization supportive of?
Well, we're also we support the act as well. Provided that there's funding that can go to pay for the workers, we would absolutely love to see it. I mean, I think the one good thing from hearing from Jeanette and Richard is that I think we're all on the same page here. We all want much better outcomes and great care and facilities. And I think we all agree that the problem right now is on the staffing side, not enough staff and underpaid. And yes, we just need to figure out a way that we can all agree on to make sure that we make these jobs more attractive, make them careers. And, you know, with the common ground that we have, you know, maybe there's a solution that we can reach here. I certainly hope so, because the millions of people that live in these buildings deserve great care.
Well, earlier this month, the New York Times published an investigation that found that at least 21% of nursing home residents are on sedatives. These antipsychotic drugs are dangerous for older people with dementia. Also, according to the report, they were often used on residents at understaffed facilities, so those facilities would not have to hire more staff. Mark, what's been your response to the findings of this investigation?
Well, the use of antipsychotic drugs has been a problem for many years. I'm not just the head of this association, but my wife and I, we built and owned and operated and worked in our buildings for many years. And particularly when you have a population that a high dementia population, particularly with some aggressive folks, it can be very challenging. And historically, the use of antipsychotic drugs has been overused to deal with that population. The sector has made progress, and I don't know if Jeanette has seen it over the years in her building, but nationwide, we've seen a 40% drop in the use of these drugs over the years. But as the New York Times article indicates, we still have a ways to go. These are prescribed by the outside doctors. We can, you know, we have some input, but not complete control. And, you know, I agree with the assessment that if we could eliminate the use of these drugs, that would be great.
Jeanette, I'd love to hear, we've got just a little bit over a minute left here, but I would love for you to tell us what you wish people understood about the reality of living in a nursing home.
I think the biggest thing that I would like people to recognize is that nursing homes are not like what the TV shows. It's not a country club, and then it's not a long medical building where people are just laying in bed all day. Nursing homes now are age ranges from 20 to 105. We had a 26-year-old and a 104-year-old woman living here. It is where people are going now to live the best they possibly can live for as long as they can possibly live. And there are a lot of challenges with that because you're dealing with different decades of people. And I think that's what I'd like people to take away from this. And yes, I believe we all need to work together to make the necessary changes so that people like myself can live a very full life in this type of setting.
And Richard, very briefly, as baby boomers age, what role will nursing homes play in the landscape of long-term care? Just about 30 seconds.
Sure. I think that there will always be a place for nursing homes because we have a population of people who are living longer with chronic illnesses, with dementia. We need to have a safe and humane and appropriate place for people to get care in a residential setting. And I think, you know, as Mark said, I think we can make it happen. We know how to make it happen in many ways, and we're learning more in terms of appropriate care for residents with dementia. It's really a matter of making sure that facilities are carrying that out.
That's Richard Mollett. He's the executive director of the Long-Term Care Community Coalition, a nonprofit that advocates for quality care for residents and care facilities. Also with us, Jeanette Sullivan Martinez. She's a resident of Pendleton Health and Rehabilitation Center in Mystic, Connecticut, and Mark Parkinson. He's the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association. It represents long-term and post-acute care providers. He's also the former Democratic governor of Kansas. Jeanette, Richard, Mark, thanks for speaking with us. Today's producer was Catherine Fink. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.